welcome to the ThoughtWorks IT Matters podcast on REST. This is part two in a two-part series, and as always, we'll begin with introductions.
My name is Chris Stevenson. I'm a developer in ThoughtWorks, I guess. I currently work out of the China office, although I've worked out of London, Canada, and India. I'm interested in REST because I think we're at a point where there's an increasing amount of complexity, unnecessary complexity, in the way that we integrate systems. And REST to me seems like a good fit for one of those simplifications that seem to periodically happen.
My name's Martin Fowler. I am a general loudmouth with some fancy title like chief scientist or something. I don't have any particular REST expertise, but I do hang around with a lot of Restitharians from time to time, and I've kind of been watching the discussion and the debate. One of the things I like about REST is it's one of these things that theoretically is really hopeless, but in practice has really worked out to be a very effective technique, and that's what interests me.
I'm Sriram Narayan, a developer from the ThoughtWorks Bangalore office. I've done some personal experimentation with REST.
My name's Jim Weber. I'm itinerant traveler for ThoughtWorks. I've no fixed abode at any given moment. I'm one of the MEST guys, currently writing a book about REST. So I have a very fence-sitting view of the whole thing. So there is an argument raging, even as we record this podcast, around a small number of IETF-sanctioned types versus the proliferation of, you know, any type you want from your domain. And I confess I'm torn both ways about that. You know, the notion of a smaller number of general-purpose data types, media types, clearly has utility. It means that I don't need specialized software to deal with them, which is great. I mean, in the human web, the browser's demonstrated that, right? I can browse a whole bunch of different media, standard media types using a single application. On the other hand, it may be difficult for me to shoehorn my particular domain-specific resource representation into an existing IETF-ordained data type, unless I send you an MP3 of me reading out some XML or something. I don't know if that counts. And of course, there was the recent proposal from what was termed, you know, the old web services guys to federate this. I'm just wondering how everyone else feels about that. Given that we are comfortable with federating microformats out to the edges of the network, why aren't we so comfortable with media types being federated out to the network? Why is there a party that feels that we have to centralize that?
But have we really got that many media types? I mean, certently with business information systems, we're just taking various structured bits of data in interesting structures, and there the great thing is it's all text, or at least we push hard for text, and we can argue about whether we want it in XML or JSON or some other kind of format, but as long as it's text, you can look at it and you can figure out what to do with it, which I think is the great point of Unix, right? If you make everything text, you can always find a way to figure out the damn thing, even if you have to use VI to do so.
Yeah. So let me clarify. So one of the things that we may choose to share is an XML schema about the structure of the resource representation I'm going to give you. And that XML schema is very deeply entwined with my domain. It's never going to be standardized by the IETF. Is there any validity in me sharing that with you? What benefit do we get from that versus me shoehorning it into, you know, application/XML and giving you much less context in terms of the information I'm going to present to you?
Yeah, I don't know whether it makes a difference in terms of media type. I mean, it's always good to have information. So, hey, if there's a way I can get the schema for this XML, hey, it might tell me something about what the hell's coming on here. But in reality, you're always going to need additional documentation, finding out about what's going on, and often an email of somebody to say, what the hell does this type field mean? Because schemas only give you so much. I still think they can be useful, but they're not as central. People always seem to think that somehow if we all agreed on schemas, everything would work beautifully well. And as a phrase that somebody, I think Dave Rice, coined on our internal mailing list a while ago, type safety is all very well, but often you need value safety. You need to know what are the values that are going on. The types are only a limited amount of information.
And I think it's a matter of who should be responsible for the way that this data is used. The XML schema kind of seems to say that the person who's producing that resource is the one who is the arbiter of any use of that resource. And, you know, you must use it in this way. And if you don't understand my schema, then you should not ever touch my data. I, as a consumer, I don't care. I'm willing to do my get. And if I understand the data, or even if I think I understand the data, I should be free to use that however I like. So I think there's a command and control aspect to XML schema that makes me nervous. I think there's also a complexity issue associated with the with the widespread use of schemas. One of the things when XML first came along, it was a breath of fresh air because everything else was so complicated. HTML was the same thing. HTML was a simplification of SGML, which was hideously complicated. XML was a further simplification of HTML. And I think we tend to go through these cycles in the industry of increasing complexity. You know, we started with something simple. XML was fairly simple. And then we got namespaces. And then we got schemas. And then we got all the WS star stuff that wraps around it and just makes it no longer human readable. It was originally supposed to be an easy human readable format. And I think in some senses, REST is pulling us back towards that simplicity, which I like.
And I think even without the standardization of media types, there is a lot of benefit to be gained just by the other peripheral things that we talked about. But if we take it within the enterprise, suddenly the potential for the standardization increases. I can believe that within an enterprise, you can certainly agree among different departments about how to represent an employee and so on. And there the potential for cross-consumption and like emergent behavior suddenly increases.
Yeah, there's a sense in which schemas and standardized media types, there's an assumption there that we as developers are going to be clever enough to write systems that can automatically consume and discover this stuff. I think that's very, very unlikely.
Yeah.
I think I think discoverability means some human is going to have to go in there and work out exactly how they want to use and consume that information.
So we're back to agreement, which is Paul Downey of BT has this rather marvelous poster which says the web is agreement. And although it might sound a bit tree-hugging hippie-ish, it sounds like you're telling me the enterprise web is also about agreement. Good luck with your consultative skills there, gentlemen.
I think in practice it is. Maybe in the minds of some enterprise architects, some sense in which their internal systems are all tied together with high reliability and XML schema and all this kind of fairly unrealistic, frankly, guarantees of interoperability. I think there's a sense in which you can control different systems within your enterprise, but there's always going to be those edge cases where, and often they're not edge cases, where you just need to do the pragmatic thing. Throw away your WS star SOAP interactions because you've got a system that just doesn't support that mode of interaction.
I mean, clearly it is about agreement, but as you often refer to the term, there is a potential for a guerrilla growth within the enterprise. Like you don't have to disturb your existing systems too much, just also expose and restful interface over them. And then there might be a potential for some serendipitous use of them.
The agreement thing, I think, is really very central. I'm going to plug in for, a much underappreciated piece of writing that is actually on my website, although it's not by me, but it's by Ian Robinson on consumer-driven contract. The notion that has been too much in the software industry is that the provider always defines the interface and the consumers just have to lump it. And you might be able to get away with that to a certain degree with internal systems, but as you spread more widely, it becomes more and more silly. And the really ironic thing about this is that this is all based around this notion of design by contract, and we use the terminology contract. And yeah, of course, this is just an appeal to the way contracts work in the legal world. And the reality is certainly between companies, one company doesn't just say, here's my contract, deal with it, accept it or go away. People negotiate contracts. It's a back and forth process. And I think we have to think exactly the same way in terms of the way the computer systems operate. And the consumer-driven contracts notion is to say, well, the consumer's needs actually help to define what kind of contracts we work with. And we have a management process that assumes the consumer is playing an active role in the way that contracts work. And I think that is such a huge step forward about the way in which people think about contracts. And that notion, I think, is very central to this kind of stuff spreading more widely.
I agree, and I think there's an interesting analogy, I guess, with the history of the web there. In the early days of Yahoo, AltaVista, and various other kind of directory services, there wasn't very good searching available for the web. If you went to Yahoo in the 90s, what you would have seen is a set of high-level categories, and then you click on the category you want, and it gives you subcategories, and so on and so on. You go through 5, 6, 7, 8 levels of category before you get to a website, and then you get to a website that some human has chosen for you. And when you get to that website, the website has a very structured hierarchical well thought out, hopefully, page flow that you are supposed to follow. It's the website itself that decides how you interact with the resources, with the information that's on that website. These days, the power of the web is exactly the opposite of that. The power of the web is in Google, is in the searching and just being able to find things and enter a website at any level. There's no way a website can guarantee the flow through that website unless they're using one of those blob formats like Flash or Silverlight. Failing that, I can go to any part of a web. I can pick out any resource. Coming back to a REST analogy, I can pick any resource or any sub resource, and I don't need to pick up the whole thing. I don't need to come through your little funnel of an API. I've got an open set of data where I can pick up the bits that I care about.
This brings us back to the big web and the promise that the big web gives us about effectively universal integration. And this is very much championed by the REST faithful. And yet, is that vision true? Is that vision true and accurate? Given today, the only experience we have of building truly web-scale, web-like systems is the web, obviously. And that particular implementation is rather constrained as to idempotent resources that you can safely cache and everything else. The slot bucket covered by POST. Are we going to be able to use the web as promised to build these big cloud systems that we think are coming? PUT doesn't work, or at least PUT's untested because HTML doesn't support it. Options, it turns out, great paper by University of Illinois, even if it's implemented, will often lie to you out of security for obscurity reasons. Which of your favorite web servers will actually support head? Which will support all the other verbs, which are actually very useful when you start to build sophisticated workflows that span the web? So are we being sold a pig in a poke here?
I think what we're being sold is certainly a hell of a lot less proven than some people like to imply that it is. But on the other hand, the simple stuff that we've got is a much more appealing base to work on than the whole WS Death Star stack.
Ooh. I've been avoiding that.
I love it. I mean, it absolutely captures how people feel about it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a perfect image, and it's there.
For the benefit of the listeners, I'm now making threatening gestures at Martin.
I think that's a good question. I think we've seen REST start to bring forth some of those advantages. We've seen some of those advantages in the REST-style systems that we've started to put together, but it is still very early days yet in terms of using this in a large scale on big systems. But it's interesting that, coming back to the MEST versus REST arguments, there are places in most messaging-based systems where messages just don't work, and what you end up doing is going towards a REST style architecture for parts of those systems. A good example of that is in medical imaging. You can't really send medical images over messages because they're just too large. That's not the sweet spot of a messaging system. So what tends to happen is that the system sends a URL. The client system uses something like a web browser, just goes and hits that URL, and it's loaded through an appropriate channel, which is an HTTP channel rather than a messaging channel.
That by itself, to me, is a very big benefit, because having hyperlinks in the response lets me get new pieces of information without having to go through newly defined verbs. And that itself is a huge benefit.
Current program of work I'm working under actually mixes these two styles in a broadly similar way. We do have classic minimal WS style based workflows at the core of our platform. And those things are safe for us because they change slowly. We can change them, so we've done due diligence around loose coupling and that kind of good stuff. But that's a core platform for us which evolves over the timescale of years. However, the information that we want to share with applications which are in orbit around this platform, we've made the explicit decision to make that web-centric. See, I don't use the R word because I'm not ordained by the Church of Rest Discuss to prescribe it. So we've made it a very web-centric way of accessing that information. We don't know necessarily 6 months out from now how that information will be combined. We will still have a platform which is mutually self-consistent and will still drive business value from what we create from customer right the way through to cash. But those applications are free to innovate, and that's really delivered a lot of benefits to this particular project I'm working on. My God, WSP breaks out.
Well, maybe it's also looking more broadly at the internet, as we collaborate on the internet for a combination not just of the web, but also of things like email is such a central thing. And there's the analogy. I mean, messaging is email, the web is the resources we need to look at. It's a combination of both that makes stuff work.
And I just want to go back to what Jim was talking about, serendipity there. By not restricting the way in which your resources are used or consumed, there is a huge potential there for emergent software and emergent uses. We've seen it already in things like the mashups that are becoming ubiquitous.
In the human web.
And I think that is a compelling usage model for the REST services that I'm going to be exposing in the future, is allowing people to innovate around those things and mash them up in ways that I never thought possible. I can't control the way that someone's going to use my services. I shouldn't, because that's the beauty of the whole thing.
We do have some duty of care to make sure that in the way that you guys might use my service, you can't damage me. So we will, you know, issue you 401s when you're not allowed to do certain things, when you need to be authenticated, and we will 409 you when you try to make an illegal state change. But that's just for our own sustainability, and we don't constrain what you do with the information, provided you play ball and don't try and damage us in return. So it's, again, a kind of broad social agreement. We'll help you, you help us, let's just not try and hurt each other. Okay, so we've had a good chat around kind of the REST esoterica and all kinds of fun stuff, but there's a practical world that we as software delivery guys live in. And once we finish doing these kind of fun podcasts, we're all going to have to go back and start building real software systems. So how might we take our REST knowledge and understanding and apply it to the kinds of things that we see for us as enterprise software developers in those communities that we serve?
Well, I see an obvious place for that in places where we have large legacy systems that are causing integration problems across organizations. A common use case for these kinds of systems, I think, is in fronting onto old legacy systems. So this idea that we've had for a while now about Strangler application, where you can put a small service-oriented front end, almost like an adapter, if you're talking in patterns, onto the front of a legacy system. Typically, these things start off as read-only. You just read the particular pieces of information out of the legacy system that you care about and expose them to whoever needs that information in the organization. And REST is a really nice natural approach to that. It has the benefit of giving you a very quick path towards a set of small decoupled service-oriented systems. And then over time, we can retire the legacy systems or add some update capabilities into our services and so forth. An example might be a legacy, let's go back and talk about people again. It's all about people, isn't it? So, you know, you've got a legacy database system that stores all your client information, all your client contact information. You just stick a REST service in front of that, and you can write mashups, do searches, Ajax-style searching for internal applications and send URLs around. Just emailing URLs is actually a really, really powerful use for some of these systems.
Or even a feed when those contacts change. Yep. I can subscribe to that feed, and I don't need to do any clever database synchronization. I just get my contacts updated automatically when my customers move addresses.
Yeah. With the emerging work around microformats, I think that's a really powerful use for that. Where we can use plugins to Firefox is probably the best one, the operator plugin for Firefox. If I subscribe to such a feed and that feed contains microformatted vCard information or HCard in terms of microformats, then I can automatically add anyone who's in that feed into my local address book. And that's a very, very powerful way of doing that. Doing these systems.
I also think that when we talk about consumer-based web applications, clearly there is a big benefit to considering exposing them as RESTful interfaces, because then you're increasing the potential for mashups happening, and mashups are good for your business because they drive traffic in various different ways. But I do think there are probably a certain class of, again, consumer-facing applications where they might not be so applicable. Like, for example, if it's internet banking, an email system, then I can't imagine exposing them RESTfully.
I'm wondering, actually, we've talked a lot about and it's not just us, but the community at large is talking a lot about serendipitous reuse. Well, we've got Mr. Agile with us at the moment. So I'm just wondering how that possible serendipitous reuse can mesh with doing things in an agile, business-driven, you know, use is better than reuse kind of manner.
Well, I think it fits very well, because the whole notion here is that if you make stuff available for people to consume, you can't imagine all the different ways that people are going to use it. So let's make the stuff available in as open and easy to use manner as you can, and let people go at it. I think if that's true in the general web, it's even more true within an organization, where business units often don't talk to each other terribly well, and they need to be able to build things more rapidly. If information's there that they can use, then they can be able to get a hold of stuff. And it needs things to be able to flow around in lots of different ways. And again, I think this notion of understanding the clear separation between the gets and anything that updates state, and also having a notion of staleness and caching and when do I need to go back, or having some kind of feed mechanism to say I'm going to get an automatic line of updates, that gives us, I think, a much better notion of how to do a lot of this than what a lot of organizations currently use, which is to put everything into this humongous database that is then very vulnerable to problems and then ends up getting locked down all the time.
Many times we go into a client and the system that we're asked to design is essentially a replica of Excel. I want lots of tables. I want this data to be presented in tables, and I want to be able to slice and dice my application information, my information, that sort of thing. A restful approach to doing that might be just to expose a web page with a table on it, an HTML table on it, and then use Excel, point it via a web query to that table. And then I can use all of Excel's features. I don't need to re-implement them. I've got that thing, I know how to use it. When I need to, I can update that web query and all my charts and pivot tables all update. It's allowing that sort of serendipity, that sort of allowing the consumer to decide how they want to use the data that I'm exposing.
So Steve Loughran of HP Labs in the UK brought this exact thing up, and he pointed out that he can pull data via a web query into Excel like that. And the challenge he made to the WS Star community was, you know, my grandmother can do it with web. My grandmother can't do it with web services because she's got to find the WSDL, generate the proxy, blah, 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 do the incantation, turn around three times, touch the ground, and then hit return.
And hope for the best.
So is serendipity an emergent property of doing web-style integration because the web is the most minimally invasive on-ramp? Is that what we're heading towards here?
Yeah, and I'd say this is also part of the Unix background as well, of saying if you make stuff available in an easily consumable form, usually text-based, people will do interesting little things with that kind of information. The important thing is to make it as easy as possible for people to get something and to be able to do something useful with it with simple, straightforward tools. And if they can do that quickly, whether it's with Unix-style text filters, whether it's with Excel, then interesting things can happen. But the important thing is you keep the barriers to taking part as low as possible so that people can just do things.
And that about does it for this week's Conversation on REST. Head on over to the discussion forums to chat with the panelists and your peers in the industry. Stay tuned for next week's topic, but until then, remember, the views expressed on this podcast are those of the panelists and not necessarily ThoughtWorks. See you next time.